This is A Christmas Story by Katherine Ann Porter. When she was 5 years old, my niece asked me again why we celebrated Christmas. She had asked when she was 3 and when she was 4, and each time had listened with a shining, believing face, learning the songs, and gazing enchanted at the pictures which I displayed as proof of my stories. Nothing could have been more successful, so I began once more, confidently, to recite in effect the following. The feast in the beginning was meant to celebrate with joy the birth of a child, an event of such importance to this world that angels sang from the skies in human language to announce it, and even, if we may believe the old painters, came down with garlands in their hands and danced on the broken roof of the cattle shed where he was born. Poor baby, she said, disregarding the angels. Didn't his papa and mama have a house? They weren't quite so poor as all that, I went on, slightly dashed, for last year the angels had been the center of interest. His papa and mama were able to pay taxes at least, but they had to leave home and go to Bethlehem to pay them. And they could have afforded a room at the inn, but the town was too crowded because everyone came to pay taxes at the same time. They were quite lucky to find a manger full of clean straw to sleep in. When the baby was born, a good-hearted servant girl named Bertha came to help the mother. Bertha had no arms, but in that moment she unexpectedly grew a fine new pair of arms and hands, and the first thing she did with them was to wrap the baby in swaddling clothes. We then sang together a song about Bertha, the armless servant. Thinking I saw a practical question dawning in a pure blue eye, I hurried on to the part about how all the animals, cows, calves, donkeys, sheep, and pigs perhaps even had knelt down in a ring around the baby and breathed upon him to keep him warm through his first hours in the world. A new star appeared and moved in a starlight course towards Bethlehem for many nights to guide 3 kings who came from far countries to place important gifts in the straw beside him, gold, frankincense, and myrrh. What beautiful clothes, said the little girl, looking at a picture of Charles VII of France, leaning before a meek blonde girl and a charming baby. It was the way some people used to dress. Child's mother, Mary, and his father, Joseph, a carpenter, were such unworldly, simple souls they never once thought of taking any time to honor themselves, nor of turning the gifts to their own benefit. What became of the gifts? Asked the little girl. Nobody knows. Nobody seems to have paid much attention to them. They were never heard again after that night. So, as far as we know, those were the only presents anyone ever gave to the child while he lived. But he was not unhappy. Once he caused a cherry tree in full fruit to bend down on one of its branches so his mother could easily pick cherries. We then sang a song about the cherry tree until we came to the words. Then up spoke old Joseph, so rude and unkind. Why was he unkind? I thought perhaps he was just in a cross mood. What was he so cross about? Dear me, what do I say now? After all, this is not my daughter. Whatever would her mother answer to this? I asked her in turn what she was cross about when she was cross. She couldn't remember ever having been cross, but was willing to let the subject pass. We moved on to the withy tree, which tells how the child once cast a bridge of sunbeams over a stream, and crossed upon it and played a trick on little John the Baptist, who followed him, by removing the beams and letting John fall into the water. The child's mother switched him smartly for this with a branch of withy, and the child shed loud tears and wished bad luck upon the whole race of withies forever. What's a withy? Asked a little girl. And I looked up in the dictionary and discovered it meant osiers or willows. A willow just like ours? She asked, rejecting this intrusion of commonplace. Yes, but once, when his father was struggling with a heavy piece of timber almost beyond his strength, the child ran and touched it with one finger, and timber rose and fell properly into place. At night, his mother cradled him and sang slow, slow songs about a lonely tree waiting for him in a far place, and the child, moved by her tears, spoke long before it was time for him to speak, and his first words were, "Don't be sad, for you shall be queen of heaven." And there she was in an old picture with the airy crown jewel being set upon her golden hair. I thought how nearly of all these tender medieval songs and legends about this child were concerned about trees, wood, timbers, beams, cross pieces, and even the pagan north transformed into a great druidic tree festooned with human entrails into a blithe festival tree hung with gifts for the child. And some savage old man of the woods became a rollicking saint with a big belly. But I'd never talked about Santa Claus because, myself, I had not liked him from the first, and did not even then approve of the boisterous way that he had almost crowded out the child from his own birthday feast. "I like the part about the sunbeam bridge the best," said the little girl. And then she told me she had a dollar of her own, and would I like to take her to buy a Christmas present for her mother. We wandered from shop to shop, and I admired the way the little girl, surrounded by tons of seductive, specially manufactured holiday merchandise for children, kept her attention fixed resolutely on objects appropriate for the grown-up world. She considered seriously, in turn, a silver tea service, $1,000, an embroidered handkerchief with lace on it, $5, a dressing table mirror framed with porcelain flowers, $85, a preposterously showy crystal flask of perfume, $120, a gadget for curling eyelashes, 75 cents, a large plaque of colored glass jewelry, $30, a cigarette case of some fraudulent material, $2.50. She weakened, but only for a moment, before a mechanical monkey with real fur who did calisthenics on a crossbar, if you wound him up, $1.98. The prices of these objects did not influence their relative value to her, and bore no connection whatever to the dollar she carried in her hand. Her shopping had also no connection with the birthday of the child or the legends in the pictures. Her air of reserve toward the long series of blear-eyed, shapeless old men wearing red flannel blouses and false white wool whiskers said all too plainly that they in no way fulfilled her notions of Christmas merriment. She shook hands with all of them politely, could not be persuaded to ask for anything from them, and seemed not to question the obvious spectacle of thousands of persons everywhere buying presents instead of waiting for one of the army of Santa Clauses to bring them, as they were all so profusely promised. Christmas is what we made it, and this is what we have cynically made of it. Not the feast of the child in the straw-filled crib, nor even the homely winter bounty of the old pagan with the reindeer, but a great glittering commercial fair, gay enough with music and food and extravagance of feeling and behavior and expense, more and more on the order of the ancient Saturnalia. I have nothing against Saturnalia. It belongs to this season of the year. But how do we get so confused about the true meaning of even our simplest appearing pastimes? Meanwhile, for our money, we found a present for the little girl's mother. It turned out to be a small green pottery shell with a colored bird perched on the rim, which the little girl took for an ashtray, which it may as well have been. "We'll wrap it up and hang it on the tree and say it came from Santa Claus," she said, trustfully making of me a fellow conspirator. "You don't believe in Santa Claus anymore?" I asked carefully, for we had taken her infant credulity for granted. I had already seen her face that morning a skeptical view of my sentimental legends. She was plainly trying to sort out one thing for another in them, and I was turning over in my mind the notion of beginning again with her on the other grounds, of making an attempt to draw, however, faintly, some boundary lines between fact and fancy, which is not so difficult, but also further to show where the truth and poetry were, if not the same, being at least twins who could wear each other's clothes. But that couldn't be done in a day, nor with pedantic intention. I was perfectly prepared for the first half of her answer, but the second took me by surprise. "No, I don't," she said with the freedom of her natural candor. "But please don't tell my mother, for she still does." For herself, then, she rejected the gigantic hoax which a powerful society had organized and was sustaining at the vastest pains and expense, and she was yet to find the grain of truth lying lost in the gaudy debris around her. But there remained her immediate human situation, and that she could deal with, or so she believed. Her mother believed in Santa Claus, or she would not have said so. The little girl did not believe in what her mother had told her. She did not want her mother to know she did not believe, yet her mother's illusions must not be disturbed. In that moment of decision, Her infancy was gone forever. It had vanished there before my eyes. Very thoughtfully, I took the hand of my budding little diplomat, whom we had so lovingly, unconsciously prepared for her career, which no doubt would be quite a successful one. And we walked along in the bright-smelling Christmas dusk, myself, for once, completely silenced.